This episode is brought to you by Rockbox Electronics. Rockbox Electronics produce some of the finest guitar pedals we've come across. My favorite is the Baby Blues. Rockbox Electronics are committed to creating the greatest sounds in rock using the best of vintage and modern technologies. Check them out at rockbox.com. Also, are you a small business trying to get things done with limited time and resources? Overflowsupport.co.nz is here to lend a helping hand. With admin tasks large or small, yes, I'm saying it funny. Why? Because I'm amusing myself. Paying for full or part-time staff when you just need a bit of extra help isn't really achievable for a lot of businesses. With Overflow Support, you just book the time you need when you need it. Find out more at overflowsupport.co.nz. Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the podcast, the only podcast you need. Today on the show, we have Harry Lyon from the iconic, legendary New Zealand band Hello Sailor. I feel like I don't need to introduce Harry or Hello Sailor. I feel like probably everybody knows all about them. I am aware that we have a lot of listeners overseas, and also there are younger people who perhaps, you know, haven't caught up yet. So, go and check them out. Hello Sailor are one of the great bands from New Zealand history. They formed, I believe, in 1975. I think they had about 5 years together before they put the band on hold, but they got back together many, many times over the years and continued to record and release records. One of the reasons why we have lined this episode up to be released now is because they are re-releasing their 1994 record, The Album. They're doing a special re-release on vinyl, and they're also doing, they're releasing a digital version which has, I believe he said, 11 bonus tracks. He talks about that on the episode, so he can clear that up if I've remembered that incorrectly. So Harry and I were talking for a while about doing this and trying to arrange it. We had planned to meet in person, but the lockdown, of course, messed that up. So this has been recorded via Zoom. Harry was up north of Auckland, in what looked like a very nice place, looking out over the water. He was engaged and generous with his time, and it was a pleasure to talk to him. But I also know that he was looking out the window, looking at the ocean, itching to get back out on the beach. And who can blame him? Who can blame him? As I record this, it is the 23rd of September, and this week it's really felt like summer. Summer is finally here, and there's a kind of sense of at least for me, I'm feeling optimistic. Perhaps that's because I've been sleeping more and working out more, and you know, I think I've been in a good place. But it's weird to feel optimistic when everything's going on in the world, and I think it's a survival mechanism. You've got to stay balanced somehow. You know, there's a lot of stuff to bring you down. But what I've been talking about with some of my guests recently, especially guests who are older than me, have been around a bit longer. You know, they've been through some stuff before. And, you know, time moves on. Time moves on. And this will become a memory. This weird phase that we're in where it's just one thing after another. But time will move on. You know, we won't have Trump forever. He might be reelected. It's not off the table. But he won't be re-elected in another 4 years because he can't be, you know. I'm worried about which way the election's going to go in New Zealand too. But again, it's going to be over. We're going to be all right. We have to be. The human race has done so many things wrong in history, but somehow we're still here because we survive. So I don't know. I don't know why I'm saying this exactly. Maybe I'm trying to convince myself. But I feel like it's important to remind ourselves, everything seems bad right now, but we're going to figure it out. I hope. And in the meantime, we can at least appreciate the people around us and, you know, the things that we've got going for us. I was just talking to a friend in LA this morning on Zoom, and we were hatching a plan to try and pack him into a suitcase or a box and courier him to New Zealand because, hey, you know, it's not a bad place to be right now. A year ago, if I'm honest, I don't think I've mentioned this before, but a year ago I was talking to a lawyer about beginning the paperwork process of moving to LA, thinking that, you know, that's what I wanted to do and how things changed. You know, now I appreciate living here more than I ever have, I think. What am I talking about? I don't know. Why am I talking? Not sure. Why am I hosting a podcast? I don't know either. But this is what's happening. And here's my conversation with Hello Sailors' Harry Lyon.
Now let's do this!
Don't give up your day job.
Well, let's start in the present. I mean, you were saying that you are re-releasing the 94 Sailor record, the album.
Yeah, I was approached by Holiday Records.
Yeah.
Who've got a little store on Wellesley Street, about if, you know, if there was any interest in releasing some Sailor stuff on vinyl.
Right.
And after a little bit of thought, I sort of landed on the idea of the album.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sent them some tracks and things, and they just loved the idea. And so here we are. And at the same time, that album has never been available digitally. So there's also going to be a digital release with some bonus tracks.
Right.
We had to actually ditch a couple of tracks off the CD because, you know, the physical limitations of vinyl meant there wasn't enough room.
Mm.
And there's, yeah, and a couple of sort of earlier fades, like we were sort of fairly luxurious in the studio if the band was jamming on an outro, you know, we just kind of let it run. But there's 11, digitally it'll be the entire album.
Right.
With the original kind of mixes and fades and stuff.
Awesome.
And then there's 11 bonus tracks.
Ah, so it's like a double LP.
Well, they're bonus tracks. They were included on CD singles at the time.
Yeah.
So, and there's some of them were studio recorded, but, you know, didn't make it on the album.
Right.
There's about three, I think, of them. And then there's a bunch of live tracks, like it's Hello Sailor playing Blue Lady for the last time at the Glue Pot.
Really? What year was that? Glue Pot would have been 90s, right?
Yeah, it would have been, I can't remember when the Glue Pot closed, but it would have been around that time, so 93, 94 or something like that.
So do you think this will be the first of a few? Do you think you'll release a few more? Re-release a few more?
Well, it would be nice. There's nothing actually in the pipeline, but
right.
Who knows? We'll see. Probably see how this goes.
Yeah. Were the other albums, the earlier albums, were they digitized at some point?
Yes, a lot has been digitized, and the first album was already, the first two albums were released on vinyl initially, and the first album was released on vinyl, re-released on vinyl.
Yep.
And it was just after Graham died, actually, so 5 years ago.
Right. And how did it perform? I mean, I know that some people talk about vinyl as sort of had a comeback in a boutique kind of way.
Yeah, I don't know, to be fair.
Right.
I'll be able to chase them up. They might owe me some money. Might owe us some money.
Does that sort of thing, you know, concern you these days? Is it about that, or is it more a passion project now or a legacy thing?
Yes, I'm driven more by, you know, wanting to see the repertoire just out there, you know.
Yeah.
For posterior.
Exactly. And is that also the reason why you recorded To The Sea a few years ago?
Yeah, I thought I'd never released a solo album, you know. And
right.
I've just turned 70. I thought, well, I better not wait too long.
But, right.
And I had a bunch of songs. You know, some of them were written, well, I co-wrote one with Delaney, Davidson, who produced the record. So, you know, there were some that were written, you know, close to the recording time. But there were others that I'd written like 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I read. So I wondered if some of the songs were actually early contenders for Sailor Records. Do they go that far back?
Yes. But I mean, I always got the kind of George Harrison slot, you know, with Sailor.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, Dave was probably the most prolific of the three of us. But he kind of recognized that the band needed to have Graham as the focus.
Right.
And so, you know, he would write songs and say, oh, no, it's not a Sailor song. You know, that's like for him.
But what if you wrote a song for Graham to sing? Or was that
He did that increasingly as the years went by. And you know, the album, to get back to that, there are like Never Fade Away is a song of Dave's. Graham sings most of the lead vocal on that. There's a great rocker on it, Please Tease Me.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham sings that. Raging with the Storms, another song of Dave's, and Graham sings that. So, in fact, the album is probably where that really started to happen.
Right. Because that's obviously quite far into your career. That's 20 years in almost, isn't it? 19 years in.
Yeah.
So it took that long for that dynamic to settle in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we recorded two albums, and early on, you know, Dave would have two or three songs, and Graham the rest, and a few co-writes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the case for the first two albums. And then there was a gap. We kind of called it a day for a while. And, you know, Dave did the Flamingos and Graham had, you know, I did Coup d'Etat and Graham had the Legionnaires. And then we all ended up in the Legionnaires, so it was kind of like Hello Sailor with a different rhythm section. And really out of that, after a while, we just relented and started calling ourselves Hello Sailor again.
Right.
And we recorded an album in 85, released in 86, called Ship Shape and Bristol Fashion. It had squillions of dollars spent on it, and, you know, mixed at Electric Lady in New York and all that
stuff. Cool.
And then, you know, as a gap, it's like an 8-year gap. And in the meantime, you know, that's quite a gap.
Right.
And we'd all been doing our own thing. And Dave was living in Europe for quite a lot of the time.
What was the relationship like between you at the time?
It was always
that part of it?
Yeah, it was always good. Yeah. It got to a point where we sort of said we broke up, if you like, when we came back from Australia in 1980. So that was after 5 years. And after that, we never said that, you know. Sometimes, you know, we were fairly confined to New Zealand in terms of where we could work. You know, we'd been to Australia, right. We'd been to the States, and it didn't really get any traction. So you just run out of things to do in New Zealand. So we'd sort of get busy and do other things.
I know what you mean. It does seem like a lot of people announce the end, like this is the last gig, and then it's a few years past, and they're like, well, now we want to play again.
Yeah, yeah. So we
it's like, why announce it?
Yeah, we decided not to do that. We'd just, you know, do some gigs. And if the gigs were sort of drying up a bit, or we felt we'd kind of saturated things, we'd just sort of do something else for a while.
Right. And what was the story with America? I mean, that's obviously, cracking America is an enormous task. And I'm guessing that you went over there and had a bit of a punt at it. I mean, did you feel like you sort of understood what you're up against?
No, not really.
And if you'd had an idea, would you have gone?
Oh, I think we were in our 20s, right? So quite young.
Yeah.
Any band that gets offered a chance to go and live in Hollywood and play the Whiskey Go-Go and do all of those kind of things that we did.
Absolutely.
I think anybody, any young band would say, yes, please, you know, go for it.
Of course.
I mean, what do you got to lose? I mean, it was tough in a number of ways. I mean, nobody had really done it before from New Zealand. So there was no rite of passage. There was no kind of New Zealand music industry network that we could plug into, which is not the case now.
Well, you were 6-7 years before Don't Dream It's Over, right?
Yes. So, you know, if it had been around that time, like if you think about OMC, Pauli Fuimana, you know, they could kind of plug into Grant Thomas and, you know, the kind of crowded house.
Right.
You know, business people got involved to help that along the way. And I think the local, the multinational companies in New Zealand, you know, the Sonys and Universal, et cetera, their reach out into the international network, I think, is stronger now too. You know, if they get something that's live and think, oh, you know, we're onto something here.
Yeah.
They're more likely to be listened to. Whereas then, I mean, we were on an independent label here anyway.
Yeah.
Distributed through Festival, that was like the mini major, essentially, just, you know, an Australian label. So we didn't have that. We couldn't even sort of call on CBS or, you know, one of the majors, and, you know, we weren't one of their artists, even if we were remote. So, it, you know, it was difficult. And of course, no email, no cell phones, no nothing like that.
Yeah. So did you have a plan, or did you just get to Hollywood and go, where should we start?
Yeah, I think that was it.
Right.
It was David Gape's idea. He sort of came in as our manager in 77, and we took off a year later. And he had some contacts there because he was one of the founders of Hauraki Radio. And they had won some international radio awards. And so he'd been to LA, I think, to receive them, and had a bit of a network of people he knew there. So And he used them. And, you know, we had interest from interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's tough. We probably could have, should have stayed another year or something. Or, I mean, our plan was to come back and then go back to the States. I mean, when I say come back, come home. And right. then, you know, work here for the, you know, a few months. Save up some dollars. I mean, we left a storage locker with speaker cabinets and bedding and, you know, I left my 67 Impala convertible parked outside someone's place, you know, to look after.
What, in LA?
Yeah, just walked away from it because we thought we were going to go back.
What, and you never went back for it?
No.
Holy shit. I wonder what the end of that story is.
Yeah, it's probably razor blades or something.
I mean, I totally understand what you're saying about being young and sort of nothing to lose. And I don't know if you guys were really, really ambitious and focused on the destination or not. I mean, I think it's possibly better if you're not about the destination, you're about the journey. Enjoy the ride.
Yeah, we definitely enjoyed the ride. We're a little bit sort of out of control.
A little bit too much.
Yeah. Yeah. So
but were you a very ambitious band? Like, were you, did you feel the pressure?
Not really. I mean, we always wanted to make a good account of ourselves when we played, you know, the gigs. Mm. We'd played a lot. And we were unsure when we went how we'd kind of stack up against, you know, the bands that were there. I mean, it's, you know, like in New Zealand, a provincial band or something coming to Auckland, one of the main centres to sort of give it a go. Well, it was scale-wise, it was much bigger than that going to LA or, and the, you know, same for people if they went to New York or London or whatever. So, but, you know, we got some gigs. And I mean, it was 78 was kind of punk had definitely was kind of established, you know, and they were talking more about new wave and bands that were coming through for the first time were bands like The Police and Dire Straits.
Love The Police.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
And, you know, just off Roxanne, you know, their breakthrough single. And they were just playing quite small clubs, you know, 400 sort of rooms.
Yeah. Did you see them?
No.
Right.
But, you know, that's what it was like. And Elvis Costello, you know, that kind of, it was like the new wave kind of thing. And that's how we got pigeonholed there. Hey, you guys are more new wave than new wave.
Well, I don't hear that.
No.
I can hear that. I can sort of hear the influence in there. But you guys are obviously a heavier band, right? More of a rock band.
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, you know, people want to put you in a box. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of bands were American, but they are from out of state, you know, the bands from the Midwest who are going to LA to do the same thing, but they were American.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them were, you know, we didn't feel particularly had their fingers on the pulse.
Right.
They were probably still, you know, trying to be the Eagles or something. You know, there were lots of beards and check shirts and cowboy hats and stuff and some great players. But we certainly didn't feel intimidated. And
I had a similar feeling when I first played in the States because I had this idea in my mind that they were bigger and better and it was like the real international music industry. And I was really surprised when I held up. And some of the feedback that I got from people who live and work there, they said a lot of New Zealanders come over and actually better. They're better musicians sometimes because it's almost like they've had to work harder in their minds at least.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, let's face it, there's some fabulous musicians in America. Some of my absolute faves, you know.
Absolutely.
Just.
But I can imagine you guys were so, you were so gigged at that point, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
You've been playing so much.
Yeah, we went.
You would have gone out there and just been completely in control of the show.
Yeah, yeah. We were, you know, young. And, but as you say, we'd recorded two albums, so we had that experience. And, you know, we'd done a bit of television. We'd done lots of interviews and, you know, all the other stuff that is kind of handy too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's hard to hang on. And the majors signed about three or four acts that season. It's kind of like a season.
Yeah.
And they're gearing up for the following summer, you know. So we did a lot of gigs with the Knack. You know, My Sharona was that. And their set was essentially their first album.
Right.
What they were playing, and they were good, you know, really tight, fun young band, and you know, people said, "Oh, it's great," you know, it's like the Beatles and the Stones, you know, the Knack and Hello Sailor,
yeah,
And we did lots of gigs with them. We played the Troubadour a lot, and they used to have, it was two shows a night. So it was like an early show and a late show. And so quite short sets, like 35 minute sets.
What were the audiences like? Because these days over there, it seems like it's basically just a city made up of entertainers. So it's really hard to get people to go to shows because everyone's putting on a show, and it's almost like LA's void of an audience.
No, it was always packed. And I mean, right. the Troubadour, we played other places, but the Troubadour is not a big room. I don't know if you've ever been there. It probably holds, mm-hmm. don't know, 200, I'd say, max, packed.
Yeah.
And no dance floor, you know, just tables right up to the stage.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's just a black box. But yeah, we played there. So we would play a set and then, you know, the next, and people could kind of come and go as they liked.
Right.
So sometimes people would turn up for the next first set and our second set and then maybe take off somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They didn't necessarily come.
Stay for the whole show.
Well, I mean, some people might've stayed for both, but there's so much to see that would be a hardy fan that would do that.
Right.
Yeah, they were fun times. Great to play there. I mean, the Troubadour is a little bit like, if you think about the Classic Comedy and Bar in Auckland, you know how it's got the bar at the front?
Yeah.
And you can go in there and you don't have to go into the venue. Well, the Troubadour was like that. It had a bar and it had a wall. And it said, over the years, Doug Wesson's Troubadour has been proud to present the following great acts. And the writing was about a centimetre high. And it started, you know, it just... You know, it started and just like.
And it must have been everyone, right?
Yeah.
Everyone.
Bruce Springsteen and Elton John and, you know, you name it. Tom Waits, Joni Mitchell, you name it. You know, it's like lots and lots and lots of people have played there. So it's kind of hallowed. You know, you feel special thinking, well, there's been some, you know, pretty cool feat standing right here.
Same with the Whiskey.
Yeah.
What was it like playing there?
Yeah. That's a bigger room.
Yeah.
But not much bigger, you know. It's like nowhere near as big as the Power Station, for instance. It's about 400, I think, was what that took. Yeah, we played there a few times.
Yep. What was the onstage sound like there? I've always wondered.
Not bad, actually. The Troubadour had a resident, you know, house sound guy that had put in this funny little PA. And the whole place was kind of tidy. And he'd made little, like, outboard gear stuff with just bending alloy.
Right.
And he had little knobs and stuff all over it. And his name was Richard. And the first time we played there, he said, like, tell you what, I can make you guys sound great in here, but you gotta listen to me. The whole secret here is you gotta keep your stage sound like really down, really quiet.
Right.
And, you know, we'd played enough through mic'd up PAs and stuff. So we said, yeah, okay. And, you know, we played, he said, no, you know, with the guitar amps and stuff. No, you gotta just turn it down more and more and more. And then we did. They were like barely on. He said, you gotta let the PA do the work, you know?
Right.
And we just kept turning down, and then suddenly just hit the sweet spot and boom, you know, you could just hear the band in the room with the PA working and everything, and you hardly needed monitors. You could just hear it.
Yeah.
And so we just knew whenever we did that the first time, and whenever we went back, we just had a little dot on our amps, you know, like, psh, you know, Troubadour settings. And because we listened, he liked us and, you know, did good things. If we'd been arrogant and said, no, you know, we'd do it our way, we would have sounded like shite, and he wouldn't have taken, he wouldn't have cared probably.
And were you, you know, internally going through any kind of roller coaster emotionally, you know, chasing the dream or anything like that? I mean, you seem a relatively even person emotionally, but I don't know if you've mellowed or not.
I've always been reasonably even, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, all sorts of things happened in LA to other people, you know, sort of cost Graham's first marriage.
Right.
And all of that stuff, you know, so it wasn't all... peaches and cream.
Well, there's a lot of conversation in our industry about people struggling with various forms of mental health and that sort of thing. But I mean, it's not an easy ride, even if you are squeaky clean of that stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, I am quite even. And I had my wife and our little daughter with us.
Right.
And they're good at keeping your feet on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, she was.
And do you think this is also something to do with your parents?
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm fortunate I did have a good childhood, and you know, I'm quite optimistic.
Yeah.
And not to say I haven't behaved badly. But
I guess I'm, yeah, but I mean, we all behave badly, but you know, just surviving rock and roll can be tough, right?
Yeah, it can be a hard life. I mean, I think it was harder for us in Australia. I mean, that's a really, I don't know if you've ever done that circuit, but that's a real treadmill, you know, getting on that. That's hard work. And
is that because of the audiences, or what's hard about it?
Just, you know, the distances are great. So the travel, oh, right. And we weren't making a lot of money. It was almost subsistence.
Yeah.
Living, you know, have to save up for razor blades and stuff, you know. Yeah. And and I didn't have my family with me then, so that was like six months away. I made one trip back.
Mm.
And, you know, so that was quite grueling. And really, that's what, you know, I said that we called it a day. That was at the end of that. We were just exhausted and kind of sick of each other, really, by the end. 5 years.
Right.
Almost living, yeah, living in the same car.
Yeah. Were you staying on the East Coast, pretty much?
Yes, yeah.
The eastern side, just driving up and down for 6 months?
Well, when we first got there, we did a tour with My Sex and Dragon headlining it, because they were just huge.
Yep.
And we played, from memory, up in Brisbane, Sydney, maybe a few places in Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide, and Canberra, in the space of a week or 10 days or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we kind of were on our own. You know, we picked up crew and truck and all the rest of the expenses and stuff that you need there. And away we went. We were based in Sydney, and we used to do like 2 weeks in Sydney, a week on the Gold Coast or Sunshine Coast up that way, you know, basically sort of Brisbane. And then 2 weeks in Sydney, a week in Melbourne, 2 weeks in Sydney, a week on the Gold Coast. we just did that endlessly, you know. Like, and then you'd like travel, if you didn't have a gig Sunday, travel Sunday, Monday, rest, Tuesday.
Yep.
And doing, you know, unis and stuff during the day sometimes, as well as pubs and clubs at night. That's
And did you at least have nice-ish accommodation and food and things like that?
It was okay, yeah. I don't know if you know Sydney very well. For a long time, we kind of lived at the Coogee Bay Hotel.
Okay.
It was kind of fun,
yeah.
You know, but we were sharing, it was shared twin.
Better than sleeping in the van, though, sleeping on someone's floor somewhere.
Yes. No, there wasn't too much of that. And when we went to, because we were a Sydney band, you know, it was tough for us in Melbourne because we were a Sydney band.
Right.
But when we went to the Gold Coast, or, you know, Brisbane, we were a Sydney band. So we got a little bit more money up there. And we got onto, rather than staying in hotels, we used to hire two apartments in a high rise at Surfers.
Yep.
One for the crew and one for the band, but usually on the same floor. And that was good, you know, sort of, I was at the beach and had a pool, a sauna and stuff. Yep. So that was, and even in the winter, you know, it's a little bit warmer and, you know.
So I've heard a lot of people talk about how not many Kiwi bands have managed to crack Australia. Have you sort of been under the same impression?
Well, I know that it's ground down a few. Like when we were there, the dudes came over and I, you know, on a wave of popularity here, and, you know, you talk to them about it, but I think they found it pretty tough.
Right.
And I think the Exponents too, I think they found it hard going.
Do you have any theory as to why? I mean, is it something to do with what the audience is looking for or something? Because they like much harder rock there, don't they?
Yes. And, you know, I hesitate to say that there's a animosity towards Kiwi acts, but, you know, that we're not Australian, and particularly then.
Yes.
They weren't going to let you into their little scene easily.
Right.
Even though we had, you know, we had an Australian agent and who worked hard for us and everything, but, you know, it wasn't easy. And, you know, the whole what makes the difference even now is media exposure. You know, airplay was much more of a thing then, like terrestrial radio, not so much now, but then that was the thing, getting on the radio. So we didn't really get a lot of airplay. I mean, we released records over there, and, you know, I think Blue Lady kind of did get a bit of airplay initially and kind of charted a little bit, but not enough. It didn't become a hit, if you know what I mean.
Right.
That suddenly, you know, that propels you into just a different stratosphere, you know, in the industries, yeah. you know, that didn't happen. So I think it's just grueling.
Mm. And when you came back to New Zealand, did you, was there a conversation about having a break, or was it just, you just all went separate ways?
The conversation happened before we came back.
Right.
We didn't announce anything, but we came back and did a short tour. We came back to play Sweetwaters and then we did a few other dates, but the decision had already been made. And then we did one final gig at the, we did announce something and we did one final gig at the Windsor Castle.
And what was the conversation like? Was it peaceful?
Yeah. It was sort of the inevitability of it. No, there were no big arguments, or it was, wasn't that. It was like, you know, we're just done with this. But I think we all felt the same.
Could, yeah, I was going to say, because it could have been worse if only a couple of people felt like that, right?
Yeah. You know, Dave had a bunch of songs that became the first Flamingos album.
Yep.
And then I got contacted by Neil Hannon and Jan Preston, who'd just come back from New York being with Red Mole. Mm-hmm. And that was the sort of genesis of Coup d'Etat. So, and then Graham kind of started his own thing, and that sort of led to Inside Out, a great album of his. So we all, you know, pretty quickly got on to solo things.
And did you say it was about 5 years before you got back playing together again?
Yeah. Well, Coup d'Etat kind of lasted a little bit. And then I ended up first joining Graham and the Legionnaires.
Right.
And the Flamingos had more legs, if you like. Like, they went to Australia, and then Dave sort of got shafted by his manager, really. So, and he took off to London and then came back, and Graham and I, you know, I was in Graham's band,
mm-hmm.
with one guitar player. It was like, you know, a trio, power trio, and Graham. I thought, well, another guitar player would be handy, you know. So they've got back from Europe and just, there you were.
And that was the beginning of it.
That was the Legionnaires. And then there was interest, yeah. because we did okay, certainly playing live. Like, we were doing pulling big crowds and stuff in the pubs, on the pub circuit.
Right.
And there was more interest in Sailor, and a few sort of whispers from overseas, you know, if you did something, recorded another album in the meantime, you know, the Don't Dream It's Over, you know, the Crowded House had happened. So it seemed more possible, you know, it had been done. And even ends before that, you know, they'd had considerable success with True Colors in the UK and Canada, Australia. So, you know, it was starting to be possible, more possible.
And when you got back together and you started recording again, was there a different feeling in the band, or was there a different conversation creatively? Were you exploring new territory musically or something like that?
I mean, of course, you know, the years tick by.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're a bit older. I mean, the year we recorded the album that sort of came out of that process in the early 80s, the very day we started recording, our son was born.
Right.
And that same year, Dave's first child was born, you know, his son. And so, you know, we're becoming family men.
Growing up.
yeah. Instead of being mid-20s, we were mid-30s, you know. And
rock and roll had changed, you know, like when you recorded and released the album, that was, of course, the height of grunge and everything. So, I mean, I guess when you first started, you were right on the pulse, and then at some point you have to go, well, you're never going to keep up with rock and roll, are you? So you just got to do what you do.
No, I mean, we're driven by songs, really. And like we like the album, the way it sounded. We recorded it mm-hmm. at York Street with plenty of time. Paul Streakstra was the engineer, and Paul sort of fastidious. And initially, Dave Dobbin was going to produce the album, and he produced a couple of tracks. Then he got all creative, you know. He had a surge, and he said, "Look, I'm sorry, but I've just got to follow this." So he recorded an album called Twist. Took off.
Oh, amazing album!
Yeah. So he said, "Oh, look, you know, these things don't come along that often. I've just got to go with this, you know." So he did that. And Stuart Pearce, who'd played keyboards with us a lot, like in the Legionnaires, actually, from Legionnaires on, Stuart's pretty much, you know, played keyboards when we've had a keyboard player. Yeah. And he'd produced Cantuta and various other people. And he said, look, right. I reckon I could do it. And he did. You know, he's so musical. Mm. But it was a very sort of collaborative approach.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, as I was referring to grunge, I was actually sort of thinking as I was saying it, that's simplifying the era too much, isn't it, to just talk about grunge? Because at the same time, REM were blowing up in a commercial way, and bands like Counting Crows were coming out. I mean, there was a real mix of songwriter bands out there as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't just Pearl Jam.
Yeah, we didn't think about that too much. Our rule for the album was, you know, we didn't want any synthesizer type sounds, you know, right. They're all real instruments, you know.
You never had that, did you? You managed to navigate through the whole 80s without sounding like the 80s.
No. That ship shape in Bristol fashion has got Fairlight all over it.
Oh, does it?
Yes. We had an English producer and he got his mate to come out with a Fairlight. And...
still, you got off pretty light though.
Yeah.
You didn't go as bad as some people.
Yeah.
So playing with the Remnants these days, do you find yourself, I mean, obviously we're not performing these at the moment, but do you find yourself when you're performing sometimes looking over and expecting to see Dave or Graham?
I'm sure we're all the same. There's nothing I'd like more than to see Graham and Dave on stage with us.
Of course, yeah. But I mean, as a reflex, you know, almost like you expect to see them and then you remember.
No, not so much now. I mean, time goes by, you know. It's been 5 years for Graham and 7 for Dave. So,
yeah.
No, they come and visit me in my sleep sometimes, but I don't.
Right.
I'm not expecting them to. I mean, sometimes, you know, you do think that, you know, I just expect they're going to walk in the door or something, you know.
Yeah.
We spent so much time together.
Well, yeah. I mean, probably in some ways tighter than brothers, right?
Well.
Having that kind of history together.
It's certainly.
I don't know if you've got a brother, but.
No, I don't. It is. Yeah. You know, it was that kind of relationship. And it's one of the things that keeps the Remnants going is, you know, Rick and Paul. I mean, Paul's in the Flamingos with Dave,
right,
and then the Legionnaires, and for quite a long time, and Hello Sailor, because he went to the UK and lived for 10 or 11 years, and when he came back, he pretty quickly became Sailor's bass player,
right, yeah.
And I think if you added the years up, I think he's probably been the bass player in Hello Sailor longer than anybody else,
right, yeah. That's the wider, family,
yeah,
then,
and so you know, a big part of us. Getting together to play is the kind of the brotherhood, you know, we like to see each other and all those gigs that you do together, there's a kind of chemistry that you don't get anywhere else, you know.
Of course.
It's like playing with those guys. For me, it's like putting on an old pair of slippers or something, you know. It just feels so comfortable.
Yeah. How do you possibly get through not only losing a friend? I mean, you lost two very close together, but with Graham, you were actually mid-tour, weren't you?
No, we were about to go on tour.
Oh, you're about to start.
We were going to be doing a 40th anniversary tour, yeah.
I had understood it differently. I thought you were actually already out playing shows and then it all got
No,
held
we
up.
were rehearsing for it, and
I mean, how do you get through something like that? Do you have to reevaluate everything? I mean...
Well... It does sort of make, well, it made me kind of look at the horizon a little bit and think about the, you know, life in general. Because, I mean, I was at Mains at the time. Mm. And, you know, sort of reminds you that life is short, really. And I did start to think, well, you know, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? I mean, I love my time at Mains and I learned a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, students, just so many great kids came through, and you know, seeing them, some of them in particular, you know, go on to great things. But you know, I started to reevaluate that and initially kind of stepped back from my dean role and just sort of became a tutor, although they gave me the glorious dean emeritus kind of title. It sounded good. So, you know, but I went back to teaching and then reduced, you know, I started working 4 days a week for a little while. And then I suppose it's 3 years ago now, over 3 years ago, just called it a day.
Right. I didn't actually realize it was so long ago.
Yeah. Time flies.
For some reason, I thought it was this year.
No.
I thought it was the start of this year.
2017, right. Sort of mid, I think June or something like that, June, July.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about making you reevaluate your life, and that was the outcome in the day job, if you like, did that steer you more towards music of your own? And I mean, is this sort of leading up to your solo album?
Yeah.
Or of course, I'm sure it made you think more about your family and things like that as well, right?
Yeah, all of that. And I've got 4 grandchildren.
Right.
And I actually started recording before, I was still at Mains when we started recording, but not for long. I think we recorded in March and I left in, mid-year, June, July.
Yeah. So, I mean, did that find its way into your write? I mean, did you write new material?
Yes.
For that album right before the album was?
No. I had a bunch of songs that some of them went back like 20 years or something.
Mm. Because, I mean, I often find that I don't usually write when I'm in the middle of an emotion. I tend to write about the thing when it's sort of in the past. It's like you've got to get away from it a little bit to be able to make sense of it. Have you noticed anything like that when you're writing?
No, I don't know. I don't think about it. I'm always kind of noodling on the guitar. And I use my phone. I've got a thing that one of the audio guys at Mains, Zed Brooks, recommended, Music Memos. Have you got that?
No, I just use the voice memo thing.
Music Memos is quite good. It's got you can put a very basic kind of drum kit on it.
Ah.
And stuff. So if you want to just have a listen, you can't play along with it. You've got to put it on afterwards. So you've got to make sure you play in time. But I just do that. You know, I'm sort of, most of the time I'm just playing the blues and trying to keep my hand and, you know. And usually there's, you know, I've got song ideas floating around the place. So if I do, I just hit old music memos and then I can come up with my little logic set up. And
so do you have thousands of them?
No. Some.
Some.
Yeah.
And what do you think do you think the disciplines necessary to be a musician or a working musician these days have changed? Like, do you still think that reading music is relevant these days? Or do you think it's more important to be an engineer, or is it, how do you see that sort of thing?
Well, you know, having some technical skills is great, because when we started, there was no option of home recording, really.
Was there anything?
Well, you could probably find an old 4-track or something. You know, of course you could. But
those little real things, eh?
Yeah. But, I mean, for a pretty difficult. And then to go to a recording studio is pretty expensive, you know.
So yeah.
There was a real barrier there.
Mm.
Whereas now, you know, if you buy, you know, I've got a MacBook Pro and Logic. I mean, for a songwriter demoing, you can do a lot of damage with that.
Oh yeah,
you can have a lot of fun. And but you need to know how to use the software and stuff. So
yeah,
that technical thing is important, part of a modern musician's toolkit, I think. Another one that I struggle with, and it must be my age, is, you know, the being a Spotify artist and your social media feed and all that stuff. I mean, I try and do it, but I think, well, right now I'm looking out the window at the beach. I'm thinking, I might be happier just going for a walk down there right now.
Oh, it does my head in. I talk about it on the show all the time because I don't see the end result. I don't see the conversion.
Mm.
You know, like I don't see it leading to any kind of monetary thing or ticket sales or increasing a fan base. I mean, perhaps for some, but it just seems like a lot of noise to me.
Yeah.
And yet it's now expected of us to be on that.
Yeah. Like, to get NZ on air funding, you've got to have this, that, and the other thing, you know, and
exactly.
So, that's weird, but there you go. That's another skill,
yeah, that is weird.
You know, for an emerging musician. And I think people like Benny and who I think is just great. I love that. You know, the songs, so catchy and refreshing. And, you know, there's people that are, you know, some of those young people are just really good at that, you know. And I think it's...
Well, they've grown up in it.
And I think the audience is there too.
Yeah.
You know, like, right. I've got friends who just, you know, if I want to tell them about the gig, I've got to email them. And some of them, I don't even know if they have email. I don't think it's too many of them. But, you know, I've got, you know, people my age, you know, old school friends and stuff, who would come along to a gig.
Right.
But short of me ringing them all up, they're not on. They don't have Facebook. Oh, no. No, don't do that.
But I think that's a valid point, because I as I question and go on about those sorts of things, I mean, obviously they work for some people. It depends on what you're doing. It depends on who your audience is and whatever. I think the thing that makes me flinch is that it's kind of a blanket thing. Everyone expects you to be on there. It doesn't matter who you are, what music you're selling. You know what I mean? It's sort of without intellectual thought. It's like, well, you have to be there and be there every day and interact. And I think, well, but I don't know if I've got an audience there.
Well, I know we do have an audience, but I mean, it's not huge, you know. I can't remember how many likes the Hello Sailor Facebook page has got, you know, 4,500 or something, which is not insignificant.
No.
You know, if we do a few dates, if some of them came along.
Yeah.
Of course. That would be good. But, you know, as you know, with social media, you can drill down into your demographics a little bit. And, you know, I can see that that's at the younger, you know, I'm not saying they're kids, but the people who are following on Facebook tend to be in that sort of 35 to 50 kind of age group. So, you know, and then it tails off once it gets into the gold card holder territory.
I think it's tailing off a little bit at the younger level too, because I've heard a lot of young people sort of laugh at Facebook, like that's where all the parents are.
Yeah.
You know, now they're on TikTok and whatever else. You know.
Well, I just don't. I just think I don't know where to draw the line.
So, just to jump back for a second, when you were in the past, you came up with a song idea, or the band came up with an idea or something. You didn't have a phone or a MacBook Pro to record the idea. How did you remember it? I heard Eddie Vedder once say that was his filter process. He talked about if you didn't remember the idea, it wasn't good enough.
That's right. That's been me. I would write lyrics down. So generally that would be enough of a spur to remember the melody and the harmonization, you know, the chords. Sometimes I might write a little chord chart. Just to remind me.
Would you notate it all? Because I know that you could read music, so would you notate stuff out?
Very rarely.
Yeah.
Mostly just, you know, the lyrics and a few chords. And most of the time just the lyrics, because the same thing. If I can't remember it, it's not memorable.
Right. Kind of works itself out.
And with the band, you know, if Graham or Dave, you know, any of us came along to rehearsal with a song, we'd sort of jam it out, and if it had legs, you know, we'd kind of learn it and then start playing it live.
Right.
And if it kind of resonated, you know, if it kind of worked, then it was a keeper.
Yeah.
And if not, you know, it's like, oh, well, next.
And by the time you're in the studio, you actually knew the song really well.
Yes.
You'd played it a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is something I've not always had that luxury.
No.
I've often been in the studio playing the song for the first time.
I didn't have that with my solo album, like with To The Sea. You know, I didn't have a band.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really been doing a lot of singing and stuff like that. So in retrospect, it would have been much better it probably would have been better all round for me and the recording if I'd done a little tour or something, you know, with it's very similar to the band that I was going to use on the album, you know, if we could have done a few gigs and kind of road tested the songs a little bit and just got a bit fighting fit, you know.
Could you get to know the songs a bit? Did you tour the album once it came out?
Yes.
Yeah. And did the songs evolve live?
A little bit, yeah. Not a huge amount. It's funny when you know, playing them live, some of them surprisingly became like a lot more fun than I thought.
Right.
Playing, you know, in the studio, you sort of record them, and then some of them like live came alive more, you know.
Interesting.
Mm.
And what are you thinking about going forwards? I mean, do you think you're going to write another album anytime soon?
I'd like to, yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I'm slowly working towards, just, you know, getting another bunch of songs. And
well, it's a good time to be creative, right, when everyone's a bit stuck.
Yeah, yeah. But at the moment, though, I'm looking forward to this Friday or Saturday when the album gets released.
Right.
And thinking about that.
So what's happening around that? What do you do in the middle of the current craziness in the world? How do you release an album now?
Well, I suppose it's going to be, you know, some media of various stripes.
Yep.
And I'll be pushing it along on our little Facebook page and stuff like that. And
what about a Facebook live performance of some kind?
Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, we live in different places. We'd have to do that, you know, all these Zoom bands. Of course, it doesn't really happen yeah. like that.
No, of course.
They record and then yeah. they Zoom mime.
Yes,
but
that's right.
I like the Stones one, you know, where Charlie and Keith just seem so disconnected. What was Charlie was playing a suitcase or something, you know, just making a mockery of it. I don't know. And it's in this case, I mean, it's not the band we've got now, you know, it's Dave and yep. Graham are all over it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't see the benefit of trying to do that.
If anything, if it was a more genuine performance, it'd almost be nicer if it was just you doing a solo tribute, a couple of songs or something.
Yeah, maybe. There are, I mean, one of the good things about the album is that there were three sort of fairly high production value film clips made that was rare for Hello Sailor.
Yeah.
When we first came along, it was, you know, to get on television, you had to go down to Avalon and appear on Ready to Roll and Grunt Machine and stuff like that, and then later Radio with Pictures. So it was like appearing on a television show.
Right, yeah.
And when they started to make clips, that kind of started to happen in the 80s, we sort of weren't around, or we sort of fell through the cracks there a little bit. There were a couple, maybe.
Right.
And then in the 90s, we did get some funding. I mean, it was quite a big project. And, you know, it was released through EMI, and, you know, they were very supportive. So we did get some money from NZ On Air, and there was other money put in as well. So there's some nice clips there. So we'll be sort of emphasizing them, I guess.
I don't know if you agree with this, but I've always thought that there are a short list of bands from New Zealand, especially from that era, that seem to have been really, they've sort of gained legend status, and you always hear the songs, you always hear about them, you know, and then there are other bands that, of course, have been a little bit lost in history. Do you agree with that? That, you know, Sailor and the Exponents and, you know?
I think it's perhaps because the band have, you know, if that's true.
Yeah.
Danny. That, you know, in the case of Sailor and the Exponents and Hammond and yep. Midge, mm-hmm. you know, who are all sort of our era,
yep.
kept performing.
Right.
So kept those songs in front of people, and it picked up other sort of half generations of audiences. I mean, look at the Exponents.
Yeah.
They probably got quite a young audience.
Yeah.
Because those songs, I don't know, have just become so iconic.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I just loved it. I went to the rugby, you know, at Eden Park. And the audience, I think it was during the 2011 World Cup, I went to the semi-final, All Blacks Australia.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And the audience just spontaneously started to sing, I don't know. And I thought, that's just fantastic, you know.
Like, yeah.
Paul Woolwright, who, you know, our bass player who'd lived in London, when he first came back, he said, it's still a young country. You know, he was a QPR fan in London. Yeah. And he said, you know what? We've got no songs to sing here. And I think that's that's changed thanks to Jordan and others. You know, that.
Right.
You know, in England, they've got, we were, you know, they've got their songs, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll Never Walk Along for Liverpool and all of that stuff, you know. They've got their songs.
Right.
And that's starting to happen here, and I like that, you know.
And it must be a nice feeling to be part of that history.
Yeah.
So where do you find your, just to kind of wrap up here, where do you find your hope now? You know, the world's in a bit of a mess. I mean, does it feel to you like it's a phase similar to, let's say, the 70s, or does this feel different?
Well, you know, this current COVID crisis thing is a bit of a 1 in 100 year. It's a major, and it's affecting the whole world.
Yes.
So it's the first time my wife and I were talking during the level 4 lockdown when we right. were sort of staying at home and all the rest of it. And even though it's nothing like it really, we're saying for us, it's the first experience of something like going through a war, you know.
Yes, that's right.
Our parents did. This is like global, and even more global than the world wars. I mean, because
yes,
they weren't actually that global, you know. They affected,
well, they weren't everywhere.
No,
that's right,
you know, like Europe. Yeah. and you know, through Southeast Asia, I guess, thanks to the Japanese. But you know, that's so it's a major kind of a thing, and it's not over yet.
No, nowhere near it.
But you know, I'm an eternal optimist, and I'm sure that the science, you know, the medical science will find a solution. I think already they're getting better at treating. There's no vaccine yet.
Yeah.
But the even though the cases are going up, the mortality rate doesn't seem to be following it, you know. So
right.
That's an initial kind of little bit of hope. I mean,
well, my question though, in regards to being like the 70s, is more about the politics in America and the division and the protesting, and
that's a separate thing, really, isn't it? You know, the Black Lives Matter and that stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably akin to the civil rights in the States. You know, the Martin Luther King. I think it's another moment, and I'm hoping that the right people end up being able to make the right moves in America
in a month or so.
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess it's I mean, I'm actually relatively optimistic about it in a weird way, because I think, well, either Trump's out in a couple of months or he's out in a few years, and either way, 5-10 years from now, we'll be looking back at this, and perhaps this is an opportunity for some better decisions to be made in the world in general, and you know, maybe we can sort out some of these race issues, climate change. Trump has become our example of what not to do. He's sort of become our rock bottom, right?
Yeah. I just, you know, if he, I was talking to our son who lives in New York this morning.
Yeah.
And he was saying that there's actually a great vibe in New York at the moment, because they had the initial thing, although there's still 200 people a day dying or something in New York.
Yeah.
Is it? Or 200 cases? Can't remember. But, you know, it's not over there yet. But
right.
He said the vibe and, you know, the atmosphere among people, he said the community spirit.
Mm.
He lives in Brooklyn. He said it's amazing. Like, people are being nice to each other and, you know, and kind of positive.
Yeah.
And so he's, you know, subject to maybe a change in president in November. I think he might reconsider if Trump gets back in. But so there you go.
Yeah.
He's a bit like me. Right. He's a glass half full kind of a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think these days you kind of have to be, don't you? I mean, really, we have to be globally to figure some of the stuff out.
Yes.
Because if we let ourselves sink into the darkness, we'll never get out again.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people just want to get on, have a good life, you know, raise their kids and do stuff. And,
right.
And you can end up with a political situation that allows most people to do that, and you know, with with dignity and stuff, you know, then
and fairness.
Yeah
let's
hope.
Well, I wish you all the best for the re-release of the album.
Yeah.
And and it's been awesome to chat to you today.
Cheers. Thanks, Danny.
Harry Lyon, yeah, hope you enjoyed that. Go and check out the re-release of the album, the Hello Sailor record from 1994. Re-released on vinyl and a special digital version with bonus tracks. Thank you to overflowsupport.co.nz, and thank you to rockboxelectronics.com for sponsoring the show. I hope you're all safe. I hope you're all well. Connect with us on social media so that I can pay my rent and I can feel good about myself and people like things. And yeah, we'll see you on the next one. Cheers.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share, and subscribe, and give us a review on iTunes.